to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Marlene Gebauer.
And I'm Greg Lambert. So Marlene, I was listening to a recent podcast on Stephen Poore's Pioneers and Pathfinders, where Steve was interviewing Natalie Ann Knowlton. And there was something that Natalie had said during that episode that I think is very relevant to the conversation that we're about to have. And that is that the legal world it uses a lot of anecdotal stories to describe how things are going on, especially in the operations of law and those relationships between corporate counsel and law firms. But based on what she was saying, we really need to do the research and collect the data and use the data to back up the stories that we're telling.
Well, our guest this week is also very much a proponent of analyzing the data to describe what's happening in the legal market and has recently produced a trends report focused on what's happening with outside counsel rates.
So we'd like to welcome Christina Sekounis, Director of Analytic Consulting at LexisNexis. Chris, welcome to The Geek in Review.
Yeah, thanks to you both for hosting me. I'm glad to be here.
Chris, the 2023 edition of CounselLink Enterprise Legal Management Trends Report was released recently, and you titled it Insights into Seven Key Metrics, In-Depth Perspective on Rising Outside Counsel Rates. We wanted to bring you in and talk about this year's report and dive into some of those numbers. But before we do, would you mind giving us a little bit of background on what the annual report measures and what the objective is for CounselLink when it compiles the report each year?
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. There are seven, as the title would imply, there are seven key metrics that we track every year. And most of them are a cut of hourly rates. So hourly rates by practice area or by law firm size, by geography, et cetera. But there are two that are not rate related at all. So there are seven metrics that we have consistently tracked over those years so that we can track the trends of them. And then as to the purpose of the report, we're sitting on a gold mine of useful data. Right? We have a benchmarking database that has well over $50 billion in legal spending, and that data spans a broad set of industries and practices. And within, you know, my own 20 years or 20 plus years at this point in the legal industry, one thing I've learned is that people want benchmarks. Yeah. They want to know if what they are doing or what they're experiencing is like what everybody else is. So we mine the data to be able to share insightful benchmarks to others in the industry. And then I think there's a side benefit that comes from being able to see analytics presented in a different way so that readers can have ideas of new ways for them to think about their own data. So for instance, we present both timekeeper rate statistics and then also blended matter rate statistics and show how that data can be presented. So I think that's useful for people to think about with their own data.
And Chris, how long have you been doing this specific report?
We've been doing this report. CounselLink has been doing this report for 10 years. This is the 10th year of producing the trends report. So it feels like a good time to really be broadcasting the value of and some of the changes that we've seen.
Yeah. So in the most recent report, you found that, you know, law firm hourly rates have increased significantly. I don't think anyone's too shocked by that. But what are some of the key drivers that you're finding behind those rates? And are clients seeing a value in return for the hike in the rates?
Yeah, and those are definitely two different questions. I'll try to hit both of them. So the increase that we saw in the past year was the highest that we've seen in the 10 years that we've produced the report. And you're right. I don't think anybody's surprised by it. We certainly heard anecdotally that rates were increasing, you know, at super high levels. I heard from a number of our customers that they were seeing double-digit rate increases. So while the average that we report in the trends report is 4.5% was the average partner rate increase, that actually I think 25% of partners actually had those double-digit rate increases. So I think oftentimes we get skewed by the average, but there were a lot of much larger increases out there. So as to why last year, why the largest increase that we've seen, you know, I think there are a number of drivers. There are economic drivers, the effects of inflation, demand is certainly a part of it, right? Lower M&A demand, other corporate types of legal work that we're hearing about are, I wouldn't say drying up, but are certainly dropping in terms of demand. And as you both know, firms typically go to two levers to compensate for lower revenue and lower demand. They raise rates and or they reduce headcount. And I think we're seeing or hearing about both of those things today. And as to clients seeing value, I think that it's fair to speculate that some do and some don't. But the interesting thing that is a separate metric in the report is that at least at a macro level, clients aren't really feeling the pain of individual timekeeper rate increases. So another key finding in this year's report is that blended matter rates were pretty flat relative to the prior year. So what's happening is that customers are changing the mix in order to offset individual rate increases. So it's either the mix of the firms they're engaging or the specific timekeepers that are working on their matters or the types of timekeepers, you know, partners versus senior associates versus junior associates, et cetera. So there are ways to mitigate the rate increases. And I think that's an interesting finding to this year's report.
Did investment or use of technology, did that have any impact on the higher rates?
No, I don't think so. So I think that it would be the opposite, right? Like we would expect investment of technology to help drive efficiencies, which if anything might drive down some rates. So I don't think we're seeing any effect at this point of investment in technology, but hopefully that's a future thing specific to AI in particular.
Yeah, and I've heard people arguing the opposite, in that if the efficiencies go up, the rates go up, because basically, you know, and they could be wrong, but I've been hearing arguments on both sides that efficiencies will drive down cost, whether that be maintaining rates or it will drive up cost and drive down time. So it's going to be interesting to watch how that plays out over the years.
It's going to be very interesting to see how AI does, how the generative AI impacts that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with both of you. And it will be interesting to see what, if any, the response is from corporate counsel as if in fact rates do go up as a result. Yep.
Chris, you found major differences in rate increases between practice areas. Why did rates increase so much more in areas like M&A versus others? What's driving that demand?
I think the answer to that is that high value work tends to get the least pushback from corporate clients. So be it M&A work, other types of corporate work, regulatory and compliance is a good example, right? Matters in those categories are often deemed as, you know, either high risk, highly complex, critical, you know, whatever the term is that's going to be used to categorize them. And nobody wants to haggle over hourly rates when the outcome is that crucial to the business. So even though demand is dropping in some of those categories, I think firms can continue to raise rates without fear of significant pushback. I mean, to a limit, of course, but I think the perceived value of that work is going to continue to fuel an increase in those rates.
And Chris, you had mentioned earlier about the blended rates and those going up a little more modestly than the hourly rates. So I want you to kind of expand on that. I mean, so how are the legal departments managing those costs in light of the higher rates? And are you finding any of the strategies that are more effective than others?
Yeah, I think that one of the shifts that I've observed in the 10 or so years I've worked with corporate counsel is that they're getting savvier and corporate legal departments have realized that while we often focus on individual timekeeper rates and approving those rate increases that are being asked for, that total fees are the product of rates and hours and who is billing those hours. So legal departments can make choices to shift to different firms and to make sure that high rate timekeepers aren't doing work that somebody else perhaps could be performing. They can also ask for budgets. They can ask for staffing lists if they really want to manage it closely. And the data suggests that this is happening because the mix is shifting. And as to, I guess, one other thing, as to strategy, so the mix is certainly a strategy, paying attention to the mix. But I'd be remiss not to point out that if any sort of fixed fee AFA arrangements are put in place, right, who cares at that point about hourly rates, right? It doesn't matter how much they're going up if you've negotiated a reasonable flat fee. So despite the fact that AFAs are not being broadly adopted enough, in my opinion, they are still a tremendously effective strategy when dealing with soaring rates like we're seeing.
So law firm consolidation is continuing, and with most companies using 10 firms or less for 80% of the spend. And, you know, I imagine, you know, it's probably easier managing fewer panel firms. Maybe you can, you know, do something with alternative fees across the board with a firm. What are some things that are fueling the ongoing consolidation? And do you expect this trend to continue?
Well, you've touched on a couple of reasons that trend is there, that it's just easier to manage fewer firms, right? That they understand what the policies are of a given organization. Their bills are hopefully going to be more in compliance with your guidelines, those things of that nature. But also, I think that one of the biggest benefits of consolidating to a relatively small number of firms is that those firms are going to have both a deeper and a broader understanding of a given client's work, of their business, which should lead to better outcomes as well as efficiency. And then I think, well, you touched on this already, that from a cost perspective, you should also be able to negotiate better fees, be that better discounts on hourly rates or AFAs, because you're more comfortable with the relationships that you have with those firms. So that increased volume should give you some negotiating power. And as to the trend itself, so in this most recent report, 61% of our customers use 10 firms or fewer for 80% of their work, of their spend. 10 years ago when we started this report, the metric was 54%. So it's bumped up to, you know, somewhere around 60%. And it's actually been pretty stable in the past several years. You know, it may shift up or down by a percentage point. And I think that most corporations have gone through this exercise of consolidation, and I don't really expect to see it increase significantly at this point, because there are lots of industries where it's just not possible. So take insurance carriers, for instance. They require firms in multiple jurisdictions, so they're never going to consolidate their legal work to just a few firms. So I think we're fairly stable. Maybe it will go up just a little bit more, but I don't expect it to go up much beyond that 60%.
It's interesting because, you know, different firms are good at certain things as opposed to others, or focus on certain things as opposed to others. And, you know, you have boutique firms that are, you know, have a lot of expertise in certain types of areas. And yet, you know, you see this consolidation. You know, it's just kind of interesting that the ease and cost and some of the factors that you mentioned, you know, seem to be important to firms as opposed to kind of picking and choosing, you know, who's the absolute best.
Yeah, I think there's the question of who's the absolute best, and also could I potentially get a better rate by going to a smaller firm? So there are definite trade-offs to having this strategy in place. You know, my advice to our customers is to make sure on the pricing side that they really thought about a strategy. You know, when do you need when do you need to go to the largest firms that are out there? Perhaps there are certain types of work where you could go down to the next tier of firms and still get just as high a quality of advice, but for a slightly lower rate. So I think there's a balance, and that's the other reason that I don't think we'll see it go much above 60%, is that many feel like they need that they actually do better by having a bigger number of firms within their pool to choose from. So it's an interesting question, and I think that we've hit that balance of having a small number of firms versus a slightly larger number of firms on their panels.
Do you see perhaps as a trend sort of going more to sort of the smaller or the mid-level firms and sort of saving the, you know, bet the ranch type of stuff for the larger ones?
So I haven't seen it. You know, one of the statistics that we track as part of the research I do in the trends report is what percentage of work is going to the very largest firms versus the next tier of firms. And overall, it really hasn't shifted much. And I look at that by practice area as well. So we haven't seen it to date in the data. Will that happen in the future? Again, I think people are getting savvier and they're thinking about their strategy. So it wouldn't surprise me if we saw some strategy of thinking about when it would be better to engage other types of firms besides the biggest in our country. Yep.
Chris, you had highlighted earlier that alternative fee arrangements or AFAs are really kind of a good strategy long-term to kind of buffer those rate increases. But the amount of AFAs has stayed pretty steady for a number of years at around 12% of matters. So it from what you're seeing, why aren't these AFAs gaining more traction? And what do you think needs to change for it to do so?
I'm not going to lie, and maybe picked up on this from my answer to the other question. This metric, this AFA metric, is a bummer, I think, to the industry. I've been in legal for a long time.
Yeah, it sounded like you were pro AFA, but I didn't want to come right out and say it.
I'm definitely pro AFA, and I think, you know, both on the law firm side, I worked, you know, for a good 10 years or so with large law firms. And now with corporate counsel for the last 10 or so years, and both sides claim to have this tremendous interest in adopting non-traditional billing. But the numbers speak for themselves, right? The needle, maybe it's moving just a little bit, but it really, for all intents and purposes, hasn't moved in the last 10 years. So why? I'm speculating a little bit here, but you know, some of this is based on what I learned from our own customers. So some of it, I think, is staying with the devil you know versus the devil you don't, right? That's one reason. Practically speaking, I think the reason AFAs aren't used more is that it's one less thing to think about. And if you think about departments that are staffed leanly, legal departments that are staffed very leanly, thinking through whether a proposed AFA is appropriate and reasonable, that takes time, and it also takes a certain skill set. So while legal departments have moved in recent years toward having legal operations functions, and some of them include people with analytical strengths and those skill sets, but many don't, right? And that, I think that would certainly help, in my opinion, to have people who have the know-how and the instincts to break down and analyze an AFA. And then another factor is that AFAs, depending on the type of AFA, can be harder to demonstrate the value of. Specifically, I've talked to procurement professionals who are involved in the fee negotiation process. And many of them prefer to stick with negotiating hourly rates because it's easy to say, you know, look, I negotiated that lawyer's rate from $2,000 an hour to $1,500 an hour. And by doing so, I saved the business X amount, right? That's a really easy way to show my value as somebody who's a procurement individual. But it's not as simple with non-hourly billing. And then I think in order to try to demonstrate the value, then many that do engage in AFAs go down the unfortunate path of requiring shadow billing, which takes away from the simplicity and the efficiency, which is one of the key reasons to have an AFA. So that's lots of reasons, maybe more than you wanted to hear. But I will say, on a positive note, we do see non-hourly billing across the board, right? In all practices, all sizes of law firms are engaging with them to some extent. And I think that clients just need to ask. They need to work with their most trusted law firms to be creative and then use their historic data to validate whether a proposed AFA is reasonable. I'm still hopeful. I'm disappointed, but I'm still hopeful that we will start to see AFAs pick up.
Surprisingly, high numbers of lawyers bill minimal hours on matters. How can legal departments better manage staffing to address that issue? You know, what should they watch out for in outside counsel billing practices?
Yeah, I included that metric about how many lawyers bill and then how many hours they typically bill. This is the first time in this trends report that I analyzed that data. And it's actually supplemental analysis to the seven key metrics that, you know, depending on the feedback that we get to this year's report, we may choose to include that every year and move to having eight key metrics that we start measuring beginning with this year. And I did that analysis for a few reasons. One is that it's been 10 years, felt like it would be nice to have something new to analyze and look at. And then also because I've actually had several clients ask me about that metric. You know, what's typical? How many lawyers should I expect to bill on this type of a matter? So as I said, first time that we've done that analysis, and I have to say the results were surprising to me too. On average, matters have 37% of lawyers billing fewer than 5 hours over the lifetime of the matter. And I should state that that's only using a population of matters that have material spend. I use 25,000 as the threshold, right? So I looked at matters that have gone through their full life cycle and have accumulated at least $25,000 in spend. And of those, 37% of those matters, of those matters, on average, 30% of lawyers bill fewer than 5 hours over the lifetime of the matter. And it's worth stating, too, that's just lawyers, right? We know that there are many other types of timekeepers that are billing on those matters. I'd focus just on lawyers. So these are indeed a high portion of lawyers that don't do a whole lot of billing. So as to what they should watch out for, what should legal departments be paying attention to? This data is readily available for any legal department requiring e-billing, which is certainly the vast majority of companies of any size these days. And my suggestion would be I'd start out by just monitoring the largest matters, right? Monitor those high profile large matters, pay attention to how many people are billing and how much they're billing. And then it comes down to communication, as so many things do, setting expectations with law firms and asking questions when the numbers of billers start piling up. One other thing I want to mention related to this is that automation can help. Right. I can only speak for CounselLink because that's who I work for. But for example, CounselLink can flag a new biller on a matters invoice. And that can lead to a conversation with whoever is looking at that invoice to say, well, we already have 50 people billing on this matter. Why did a new one suddenly pop up? Right. Also, automation related, our customers can require staffing lists, which will enforce that only pre-approved timekeepers are billing on a given matter. So in addition to kind of auditing and having some sort of analytics and reporting to be able to track what's going on, automation can make a big difference.
Yeah, our friend Toby Brown would also point out that there needs to be better scope on the matters so that you don't see this, or if it...
Yeah.
And I guess a prime example, which would be legit, is let's say you're doing some kind of deal and then there's a tax issue. Well, there might be a tax lawyer that comes in that gives 2 or 3 hours of advice on that particular issue. Is that in scope, out of scope? That you know, those sorts of things. And of course, you know, communication, everybody's terrible at talking to one another, apparently.
Yeah, that's, and it's a really good point, right? So I'm speaking about the numbers, but there are certainly legitimate reasons that people, that lawyers need to be brought onto a matter for just a short period of time. But, you know, to your point, it comes down to a conversation. So make sure that you understand the reason for that and are communicating expectations and what is in and out of scope. The related thing to scope, of course, is budgets too. That's the other tool that, that both sides can use. Let's create a budget and be specific in that budget and talk about who needs to be involved in the matter in order to be able to hit those budget numbers. So yeah, good, really good point.
Speaking of adding some new data to the list, you provided some new data on international lawyer rates this time around. So what were some of the key drivers behind the different rates between countries, and how are U.S. companies leveraging international firms in their work?
Yeah, so this is the third year that we've actually included non-U.S. rates in the trends report. But each year we've added additional countries and or practice areas. So we have reported on international rates for a few years, but I did expand that a little bit this year as we have more and more volume to be able to speak to. So I can't really speak to what drives specific individual country rates. You know, differences are definitely going to be affected by economies of that country, of those countries, political stability. You know, multiple factors are going to come into play as to why the rates in India are much lower, for instance, than the rates in Japan, right? But as to how international firms are being leveraged, many of our customers need outside counsel advice outside the U.S. for multiple reasons. You know, maybe regulatory advice in a specific country, litigation might pop up from a specific country. Patents is a really big reason. You want to file a patent in a particular country, so you need some advice within those countries. In fact, 10% of the spend flowing through CounselLink is from non-U.S. law firms. So it's definitely material, and it's growing. So we know that more and more of our customers are needing to seek outside the U.S. Advice. The benchmarks, I think, are super valuable to a company who either has never needed advice from a firm outside the U.S. or just needs to engage a firm from a country they haven't used before. So, you know, say suddenly I need a lawyer in Brazil, and now I can look at those benchmarks and know that the rate that is being proposed to me is at least within a reasonable range. So again, I think the value of benchmarks in general is having a comfort level that something is normal or similar to what others are paying. So I expect to see, you know, more and more of the international data coming through CounselLink, and we will continue to expand on what we include in the trends report.
So if you compare today's data to 5 to 10 years ago, what do you see are the biggest shifts in how companies are managing costs and working with outside counsel?
So as you both know, our industry moves slowly. So there aren't huge changes that I've seen over those 10 years. But, you know, there is
glacial
movement in even 10 years of data. But there are some. If I go back 10 years ago, then I do start to find some differences. Like I mentioned, the 54% consolidation to 10 firms or fewer versus 60, right? That's actually pretty significant over the course of 10 years. So that's one, I think, slightly more consolidation that we've seen in the last 10 years. And then that increased attention to timekeeper mix. You know, I think I really feel like in the years that I've worked with corporate counsel, it's always been about timekeeper rates, individual rates. I'm not going to pay this much for that person. But anecdotally, I'm hearing, and we're seeing in the data, especially this year, that people are paying attention to that mix. And anecdotally, the other thing I would say that I hear more now than I used to from our customers is a greater willingness to change firms. right? Even those that they've had longstanding relationships with. And part of that, and this is outside of the scope of the trends report, but I think that many legal departments are taking more things into account when they consider whether those relationships should continue. So diversity is definitely one within the last few years that while I would say every customer I talked to said it was important 5 years ago, now I'm hearing that they will actually move work away from a firm that is not improving or showing efforts to improve in diversity. So yeah, absolutely. Some shifts just awfully slow within our industry.
So Chris, if you were to present this in person to a group of in-house attorneys and outside counsel, and you were to, you know, hand each one a copy of this, what would you tell the in-house counsel what they should, you know, what's the number one thing they should look at? And what would you tell the law firm leader the number one thing that they should look at?
So I think my answer to that question is a high level answer to that question. It's really about using data. And this is where I geek out when I talk to our customers. I tell them my job is to help you use data to improve all of the decisions that you make within your departments. And so here in the trends report, we are providing external benchmarks, but in-house counsel, again, assuming that they have some sort of enterprise legal management system in place, they have their own data to benchmark internally. And that's really even more important than looking externally, right? Is my own, are the rates that I'm paying across the spectrum of firms that I work with consistent? Am I paying rates that are increasing a lot every year? And then sure, the external benchmarks are valuable, but that using your own data is the place to start. And then the same applies to law firms, right? So if we're talking about a partnership here where corporate counsel rely on their outside counsel to help advise them. So they have this internal data that they can be using, but law firms have their own internal data. So as an example, you know, going back to AFAs, I'll just keep beating my AFA drum. So if a given client says, we've got no experience in using AFAs at all, right? And should we use it for employment work, for instance? And a law firm that they partner with could say, you know, 20% of our customers who are in your industry are using flat fees for immigration work or whatever it might be. And this is something you should consider because our data helps support this, right? And so as long as you're within the bounds of privacy sharing that information, data really is a two-way street. I would love to see that data being used proactively and collaboratively between in-house and outside counsel.
Chris, so now's the time where we ask our crystal ball question. So you pull out your crystal ball and you look into the future and tell us, you know, what changes or challenges do you see over the next 2 to 5 years?
Well, you kind of teed me up earlier to do this, but I can't walk away from this discussion as a LexisNexis employee without mentioning AI, right? Figuring out where AI can and should play a role in increasing efficiency and ultimately reducing costs, in my opinion, is going to be a focus for many. It'll be an interesting path to see how we get there. And I think we're at the very, very, very beginning of that path. But hopefully within 5 years, many will have figured that out as to what role AI can and should be playing. And then I think the broader change I think we'll see is that data and having access to data continues to make us all smarter.
All right. Well, two very good predictions, I think. So Christina Sakunas, Director of Analytic Consulting at LexisNexis, thank you very much for coming in and discussing the survey with us today. This has been fun.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
And of course, listeners, thanks to all of you for taking the time to listen to the Geek & Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We'd love to hear from you, so reach out to us on social media. I can be found at GabeBauerM on Twitter.
And I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter. Christina, how can people reach out to you if they want to learn more?
They can find me on LinkedIn. That'd probably be the easiest way.
All right. And we'll also make sure that we put a link to the survey as well on the show notes as well.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments, you can also leave us a voicemail on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the beer is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.